Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Diecast Movie Podcast, where we do two types of movie episodes. Movie discussions, where generally we roll a die to decide the genre in the movie we're going to discuss, and also interviews. And today we're doing a special episode where we're going to be continuing on our Charlton Heston retrospective series with the Omega Man. Of course, I'll be joined by Joshua Kennedy, and Josh asked if we could have a guest join us because he knows this guest really loves the Omega Man, and that's Mark Maddox, and you're going to be hearing from both of them and myself in just a couple of minutes. I just want to thank everybody for tuning in to listen, and I just want to say that before we start the episode, we're going to have a special little treat before we go into this episode, and that is we're going to listen to Omega Man by The Police. And right after that, Josh and I and Mark are going to go into the Omega Man and talk about Charlton Heston's 100th birthday. Again, happy birthday, Charlton Heston. 100 years old today if he was still alive. So I hope everybody enjoys the episode. Now let's go into the song from The Police. Hello, everybody. Welcome to a special episode of the Diecast Movie Podcast, where we're going to be celebrating the 100th birthday of Charlton Heston with the Omega Man. We're continuing on our Charlton Heston retrospective with my pal, the number one guest star of all of the Diecast Movie Podcast, Joshua Kennedy, international filmmaker of mystery. And he said, Steve, this movie is so big. This movie is so tremendous. We got to bring in another person. And I said, Josh, who? And he said, Mark Maddox, who everybody remembers from the episode in the airport. How are you two guys doing?
Fantastic. It's a thrill to be here. Thank you for having us. And thanks for jumping on, Mark. Can't wait to talk about this.
Yeah, I'm doing all right.
All right, that's all we got.
Yeah, we're talking about one of our favorite films. Don't mess with Chuck. Nobody messes with Chuck. Yeah, now we're talking.
Now we're
in our domain.
Mm.
So Steve, just get up and just walk away. Walk away from the mic.
I know
this show's ours now.
Yeah.
this could go. I think this is going to go extremely well, or it could be. It could go. Well, I've had episodes where I've had very little to say because people just want to give the mic. I did interview David the Rock Nelson, so I mean.
Oh, okay. But that was smooth.
Yes.
It's an experience. Yeah. I recommend listeners go back and listen to it. It's probably the most attention deficit driven person I've ever interviewed or met. And his love of movies and his passion to making films is bar none. Now, the quality of his movies, but I mean, you know, but the love and the talent's there, and it gets movies out. So I got to appreciate it, and his heart's in the right place. And Josh, being a filmmaker, I'm sure you're the same way. Your quality, in my opinion, is better than those movies, the Rock, but everybody has different opinions.
Well, and it's the amount of people, I'm sure you guys know, the people that are like, I have the greatest idea for a movie. It's like, I want to make a movie, and they never do anything with it. So it's kudos to him for actually getting stuff done. No matter what, you know, what he gets it done and he gets it out.
Exactly.
So, yeah.
It's, you know, there's people that I've actually met musicians and other artists and other filmmakers that like criticize people that are doing it because they know so much better. And then you go, so which ones have you done? Nothing.
Yes.
They've just talked about it. You've got to roll up your sleeves and you've got to do the work. So,
mm-hmm.
yeah. Mm-hmm. So, okay. And Steven, go ahead and get us going on this film. What happened? You want to get the ball rolling? Give us a, what do you call it? An intro about it? Or
well, we're going to do something special. We're going to have Josh give the synopsis of the movie. So for listeners that have never seen this movie before, they'll have a rough idea. Because even though the movie's been out since 1971, I'm still a firm believer that there are people that listen to the podcast and they're like, what? And we're going to, I didn't know this movie existed. And then they're going to discover it. And then they're going to go out and watch it. And they're going to be jaw dropped with the glory of Chuck. And you know, what else can you say? I mean, if you love Charlton Heston, Chuck, you'll love this movie.
Chuck is the beginning, the middle, and the end of all things.
So I'm going to top that.
I can't top that intro. That's a,
well, it's an intro, but you're going to try to top it with the synopsis. And to do it justice, Kevin, we're going to play some music for you, Josh, to get you in the mood for it.
Oh, boy.
So, the time is the not-too-distant future. The place, Los Angeles. A plague has wiped out all of humanity. But yet, one man stands alone. Colonel Robert Neville is the Omega Man. I should have just memorized the trailer. Is the Omega Man, and he is not alone. For the people who have died from the plague have mutated into pale, vampiric-like monsters that prowl the night land of Los Angeles. And it's up to Robert Neville to stop them and survive himself. He is the Omega Man.
Excellent, Josh. Excellent. And that way we don't spoil the ending for people. But we probably will spoil it at the end of the podcast. We'll give a spoiler warning for those, you know.
Oh, there's going to be big spoilers because we're going to live this film.
Yes. And I know both you gentlemen have seen this movie way more often than I have. But since Josh did pick the movie first, we're going to start with Josh's experience with the Omega Man, and then we'll go to Mark, and then I'll throw in my opinions on there too. But Josh, what was your first experience with the Omega Man?
I mean, perfect segue. I have to thank you guys. You, in your airport podcast, you did mention my dad, and that was very, very kind. I was very touched by that. Thank
you. Welcome, sir.
A wonderful, wonderful podcast, by the way, at the airport thing. You guys were like, what was the name of that guy? And I was like shouting into the phone. I was like, it was Mel Bakersfeld. It was, yeah. So, but it warmed my heart. That meant a lot to me. So thank you for that. But so perfect segue. I had seen The Last Man on Earth with Vincent Price, which is the first adaptation of I Am Legend by Matheson, Richard Matheson.
Mm-hmm. Richard Matheson. Mel Bakersfeld.
And he,
sorry. Oh,
I see what
sorry.
You did there.
Wrong
I see
answer.
What you did there. Yeah. Vernon Demarest. So I had seen Last Man on Earth, and I mean, it was on VHS and watching Last Man on Earth. And Dad comes in one day, and he's like, "What are you watching?" I was like, "Oh, it's Last Man on Earth." And he goes, "You know what you need to see?" He's like, "Charlton Heston made a version of this." I'm like, "Wait, what?" And the Omega Man was one of the first, probably the second DVD I ever owned. We bought it, and he said, we didn't even have a DVD player. We had his laptop from work that had a DVD drive. And he and I sat down and watched it. And I mean, I had to have been 6, 7. We watched it together. One of the few movies that he really pushed. He's like, "You need to see this." And I had been hooked ever since. Mark, did you get to see it in its original run?
I remember at the air base in Goldsboro, North Carolina, the little theater that we had, that I saw so many hundreds of great films, because it was a new movie. It was not a new movie. It was a different movie every night. So they had a bunch of old stuff, new stuff, everything.
Nice.
But it came on, and my brother went to see it. My parents, it was rated PG at the time, and I was just at that tipping point. PG had a lot more strength to it.
Yeah.
Then PG or PG-13 does now. Even PG-13. PG back then had more strength to it than PG-13 does now, in my opinion.
Absolutely.
And so my brother saw it, and he liked it. Then I saw it when it came on the NBC Saturday night at the movies.
Okay.
And it came on. It was great. The next day, on Sunday, the kids were out playing, and almost every kid that we were playing outside with had seen the film, and we were all affected by it. We were all sort of like affected by the tragedy of it, the sadness, the pathos, the sacrifice and everything. And it, you know, I mean, it's a, you know, it's got its tear jerking moments, you know, and so it really did a number on a lot of people, and everybody was already sci-fi, and Charlton Heston were kind of synonymous because of Planet of the Apes, Beneath the Planet of the Apes, and then right after that came out Soylent Green. So he was kind of the movie theater science fiction man to go to. Who was as big as the science fiction universes he was in? It wasn't like Richard Dreyfuss in Close Encounters. Richard Dreyfuss was a regular old guy in a colossal situation, but Chuck Heston was as big as the universe he was in, and that made it fun for the kids. And so, yeah, I mean, I fell in love with it. I've been a fan of it ever since. And also that same night, I didn't know this. I was watching it out in the living room with my parents, but my brother had actually audio recorded the last 30 minutes of it on a cassette, I guess because he liked the film, already seen it, and liked the music, and he recorded the whole ending, you know, where they end up in Robert Neville's apartment where the family shows up. And he recorded it, and he played it for himself several times, and then I stole it from him. And then I kept it for a very long time until, like, years later it came on, and I recorded the whole thing on reel-to-reel. The whole movie came on from out of Atlanta. So that is one of the reasons, too, and this goes to the music of the film. The music and the pacing of the movie and Charlton Heston being in it, just audio wise, it's a great movie. That's a separate thing from the visual. It's just great on that level too. So big fan, massive fan.
I first came across it on TV. I can't remember if it was during the Sci-Fi Theater on one of the Saturdays or if it was one of those things on Saturday night, whichever the case, that was the first time I saw the Omega Man. And I was, I don't know, like 10 years old, 11 years old, and you're just watching it, and it's just one of those things that can happen in real life. And, you know, as we all know, especially now recently, in like recent years, everybody's all worried about pandemics, germ warfare, and so on. And this movie deals with it, you know, right off the bat, 50 some odd years ago. And it's the imagery in it was very good. You know, I just enjoyed that. Charlton Heston just owns the role. I mean, really, it's obviously he's carrying the movie. He's in the movie by himself for large chunks of the part. So you have to really enjoy what he's bringing and doing. And I love the lack of people. the lack of the silence, of the showing of the streets being so empty. I mean, and what I mean by liking about it, it just, it makes it where you just feel like it's just that emptiness, and how it, people haven't been able to film that way until the pandemic, when a lot of places were closed, and then filmmakers were able to take advantage of those empty streets and really get some great footage, especially for independent filmmakers like Josh, where you'd have no way to pull it off on a normal budget, but suddenly, wait a minute, there's nobody here, and you're able to drive around in your car and get those shots that you might not have used yet, but you know you got them in that pocket for down the road. And I think that's,
yeah, it was
the
Sunday. I think it was Sunday morning shots of the business district of Los Angeles. So I'm sure they still had to block it off. And unfortunately, with modern high quality super images and 80 inch size TV sets, and me standing right in front of it, like a foot away from the screen, you can see guys walk out into the street and go, and like way, way, way off in the distance, they come out and they go like this.
Yeah, yeah.
Filming a movie, then he turns around and walks back in, and then way up on a mountainside there's a car, or there's one where a car is going off on an off ramp and stuff like that. It doesn't ruin it, because we know, because there's so many things in this film with the budget that it had, that the world would look different. Buildings would be more grungy. There'd be more like, you know, and I'm not a fan of the Will Smith version of the third version of this film, but things that would be right, like grass would be busting up through the asphalt and all that. That's all true. But this movie didn't have that kind of a budget. And most science fiction films didn't have that kind of a budget. I mean, Planet of the Apes was $5 million. That was a huge amount at the time. But this still had the heart of it, and it's like you immediately get to the fact that this guy is by himself, you know, except for something weird when he pulls out the machine gun and starts shooting at the shadows going across a window. One of the things you said, Stephen, was interesting to me about the pandemic and stuff. I was taking my children back to their mom's house. They had had their visit with me, and I was taking them back during the pandemic to Cordele, Georgia. She picks them up and takes them back to Athens. And we were on our way, and Ava says, put on the Omega Man soundtrack. So I put on the Omega Man soundtrack. Yeah, my kids are cool. On the Omega Man soundtrack. And we're going down the road. And of course, nobody's on the streets. This was when it was really in the thick of it, on the streets. And the Omega Man soundtrack is playing. And we go through the small little Georgia town called Omega.
And no.
Ava and I just looked at each other and just said, this is getting weird. And there's nobody out. There was nobody. And we were playing that. Which, by the way, I do have a question. Why does he push in the
eight-track tape?
This is Frank Sinatra, and then a Summer's Place. So I don't care. It's still cool.
It's still cool, and I bet we wouldn't have been able to notice it except without the HD playback. It's like,
damn,
it's Frank
HD.
Sinatra.
Damn HD. I hate it.
Mark, wait a minute. I just want to save it. It was a bootleg copy that he bought that somebody just taped over, put the thing over it, so he didn't know that it was a bootlegged version.
Oh, thank you, Stephen. That's why we're friends.
Theme from A Summer Place was played over the Franks, and it was taped over the Franks.
I wonder, in reality, I wonder if it was like they had planned on doing Sinatra, and they go, oh, he's too expensive. We have to pay for the rights or something. That's probably close.
That's exactly what I think. And the fact that Summer Place is on the soundtrack, I'm like, I bet it was just so much cheaper to just do that and keep it on the actual, instead of getting a licensing, exactly what you said. Two things I wanted to bring up right in line with that, because I did my own, I wanted to see how long I could last without bringing up my version of the Omega Man, the Alpha Omega Man, my senior thesis project.
In France, it's called, AKA, it's called Omega Man on the Bicycle.
Yeah.
Sort of like, we always call it, here at the house, we call it Omega Man on the Bicycle, which is, it's the French edition, which is supposed to be a takeoff of the Bicycle Thieves.
The Bicycle Thieves, exactly. I'm going to start referring it to that.
And Josh, are the rumors true that there's a Swedish version of your movie?
Oh, yeah. I make no comment. A lost Japanese reel of the Alpha Omega Man. So do that. I was 2016, and we spent so half the semester was just waiting for people to get out of shots just to get empty shots of New York. And then the pandemic comes around, and I'm like, really? Of all the time, like, I wasted so much time waiting for empty streets, and then the pandemic comes. I could have waited 4 years and get that actual footage. But right. So there's one. And then the second one was right when things were getting scary. I mean, right when the pandemic was taking, it was like, okay, we're locking down, schools are out, we're stopping. I thought, I was like, you know what's going to be cool? I'm going to put the Omega Man on. That's going to be a great, you know, I'll be home in my pajamas and watch the Omega Man. And I got about 10 minutes in. And it was just a little too real. I love this movie with all my heart. I was like, okay, this is, I need to turn this off. I'm going to get depressed.
So what a sissy.
I know.
We watched the double bill of the Omega Man and Andromeda Strain. That's the way my family rolls, you know?
We did Andromeda Strain. We did Contagion.
Really.
The helicopter
Attack of the Mushroom People. We did everything. Anything where people are just getting infected.
The bad people. Oh,
the bad people.
See, unlike you guys, Mark was working for the pandemic because he's an artist, so he, obviously your commute was infected. Everything was pretty much the same, but
about,
I was, I'm an
20-yard commute.
20-yard commute.
From the bed.
And I'm an essential employee, so I'm still driving back and forward to work. And when you're driving on the highways, I mean, it was just like, you know, you and 12 other people. And it was just bizarre being out there on a daily basis. And you come back and your family's like, so what's it like out there? What's going on? You know, is everything okay? Is there still people? I mean, it was really weird because you felt like you're giving these news reports and saying, yeah, I saw somebody walk a dog around the corner at this one area. So there are still life, signs of intelligent life, because I saw the dog.
Bizarre, isn't it? Yeah. You know, Josh, I do have a sequel that now, well, if we get another pandemic, I want you to go ahead and film it, because what it is during the pandemic, I unfortunately, my mother accidentally threw up my dad's Air Force cap, which always made me mad. She was tossing a lot of stuff out after he passed away. And I said, well, where's his cap? Where's his Omega Man cap? And she goes, son, everything's gone. And I was like, not happy about it. But anyway, you can go buy one off of eBay or something. But anyway, so I'm during the pandemic, you can't really go many places. So I go ahead and every afternoon I put on some music out at the pool, and I play some days I play the Omega Man soundtrack really loud, and I jump in the swimming pool and I do laps. And I thought we could do a sequel. Neville doesn't die. He's just knocked out. And then he goes back to the hospital, gives himself a blood transfusion. And then he goes, and it's called Omega Man in the Swimming Pool, where he comes back. And they never showed you his pool that he had in this place. And Matthias is in there, like, drinking a big old Thirst Buster Coke or whatever. And Chuck just leaps through the air with that machine gun. He doesn't even shoot him. He just lands, like, cannonballs right in the middle of him. You know, you bastard. Oh, by the way, Steven, are we allowed to cuss on your show a little bit?
Mark, I'm always ready to put explicit. I had Ron Perlman on the show, and we weren't explicit. So
okay, never mind.
So
all is good.
We're safe.
I think sometimes it's funnier, the energy is better if you're going to say something profane, and if you feel you have to bleep it, that's fine. But
I don't bleep anything. It's just what I flick.
Some people get mad at me when I cuss on shows. I don't want to like do a string of expletives, but I still think every once in a while a good zinger's okay.
Well, Josh was doing a string of expletives when he heard our airport thing saying, it's this guy's name, and he's probably yelling all these words, but thankfully it wasn't being recorded at that time. But the thing is, I'm not going to bleep stuff. I just switched the little tag to explicit. And instead of family, and that way people know.
Oh,
it's really hard. It's like, I'll click this, and then you're done. It's not that difficult.
It's a lot of work, I know.
Well, what's the noise? Is it ooga or something like that, like an old car horn or something? Or
I don't bleep. I just said I just switch it to explicit so people know there could be profanity
in the description.
Oh, so you leave the profanity in?
Yeah.
Oh, that's nice. That makes me feel good. That makes me feel warm and fuzzy.
Feel warm inside. All right.
What words can I use tonight?
Yeah. So I mean, you know, but
it's a smorgasbord.
Yeah, but you know, I will warn people. Like in the beginning, there could be some profane because most episodes don't have it. So that way, if they have young ones listening, they'll know. Because not everybody sees.
It's Charlton Heston. There's got to be at least a little bit of profanity. You know,
exactly.
I'll never forget my mom. what she wasn't yelling. Me and my brother were watching a 2 minute warning. And like this, the guy opens up on the football stadium. He's like shooting people, shoots a woman right in her collarbone, shooting people, all this kind of stuff. And my mom goes, I just can't believe how much Charlton Heston is actually cussing in this film. And I'm like, people are getting blown away. There's blood spraying all over the place. Cops are being shot. And I'm like,
God forbid he cusses.
Really, Ma? Really? So anyway.
Well, you got to draw the line somewhere. Obviously, listeners, if you're listening to what Mark said earlier, we have spoiled the ending already. So the ending of Omega Man.
Did I spoil?
Yes, you did.
What?
Yes, you did. Because you said if there was a sequel, you'd bring it, and he didn't die. I mean, you pretty much spoiled the end. Oh, so, but.
Too bad. Not part of the cult of Chuck, but, loser.
But yeah. I want to tie in, since you did that, he gets a spear to the chest, and that takes him out hours later. Yet he goes down in a helicopter that goes up in a ball of fire. And basically just has some little scratches on him and gives himself the vaccine to survive. He survives a helicopter fall. Can't survive a spear.
It bounced. He fell out, and then it flipped over. The blades did all that breaking apart crap that they do in more expensive modern films. Mm-hmm. And then it blew up. Nothing happened to Chuck.
It went behind a mountain, and we saw.
Yeah, you have no idea, Stephen. You know, you give with one hand with the 8-track tape thing, and then you take with the other. What the hell's wrong with you?
I'm just saying, I think spears were like his kryptonite. Modern technology cannot take out Chuck. It had to be primitive tech. See, Matthias was on to something. He was like, we can't use the guns.
Boy.
We
can't use the wheel.
We got to use old school. And that worked. So Matthias was onto something without even knowing it, because he didn't know about the helicopter blowing up, not being able to take out Chuck. Nuclear weapons cannot take out Chuck. Nothing can take out Chuck but a spear.
A spear. Well,
Steven, from now on, any convention I see you at, I'm going to look at you sideways. Because I go, any friends go, why do you look at him like that? Because he goes toward Matthias.
Yeah, he's on Matthias.
He's on Matthias's side.
He's team family.
I'm not on team family. I'm just telling you, you can appreciate evil when it's thinking out right. I don't make any sense.
That's all you'll need.
I feel like that Star Trek episode it was the Star Trek episode where they were talking about Khan and what was it, McCoy or somebody was like, how can you be talking to, we can separate, what the things he was able to do, even though he did all these evil.
Well, that's the point. Matthias, in a way, has got a point that man's technology got so far along that we did destroy ourselves. That's the point of a good villain, where you look at somebody and go, I get some of the points, and I also see the tipping point where they've gone too far. So yes, even today when I was watching it again, but then you get the get out of jail free card, that the mutation that they've got, the disease that they've got, the infection, whatever you want to call it, has him in a way. He's making like a cult sort of he's got this cult thing going, but then there's that tipping point, like. He's gonna, he kills. Was it Richie?
Richie.
He kills Richie. It's amazing how many times I've seen this film, and I know it's performance anxiety. That's what it is. I'm sorry.
All right, calm down. Take a few breaths.
Take a few breaths. Take into a paper bag.
You can make it one of those.
And he sits and he goes, "Richard, you are damned."
Yeah.
And it's one of those where, of course, Richie at first is like looking at Chuck and going, man, you're hostile.
You're hostile.
And then Chuck is nice to let you stick around or whatever. And so, but then Richie goes down to the Civic Center where they're hanging out, probably waiting for the Taylor Swift concert. And they're there. And then Richie starts to realize, maybe I made a mistake coming down here and trying to talk to these guys.
Yeah.
Because even when I'm listening to it, to me, I'm like, Richie is actually saying something really good. You guys can't stand the light. You've got sores all over you. You guys are dying off, all that kind of stuff. Okay, forget the way Richie's saying it, but if you guys, you could still have your cult. Yeah. But you could live. But Matthias doesn't want to hear it. To him, it's all bad. Mm-hmm. And that's him. He's just over the, he's gone off the deep end completely, plus whatever the infection's making him do. Yeah. I mean, let's go.
One thing before, just to tie in on that a little bit, before,
sorry,
when Richie and Neville were talking up on the top of the building, and I thought this was a very big turning point for Neville's character, for Charlton Heston playing well, because earlier he's like, I want to know where the nest is. I want to take him out. And he's going through this one man Rambo crusade through the movie, you know, which we all assume has been going on for years, like at least a couple of years. And right. Richie finally tells him where the nest is. And you could see it in his eyes, like, I can go do this. But then he's like, no, I'm going to walk away. I'm going to let it go. And yeah. I thought this
he's
is a man.
He's going to walk away because, one, there's children. He's actually falling in love with this woman.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, I mean, it's one of those things where it's sort of like, I don't know. There's a bit of a thing that irks me, and I think people hook it together, like the character in the movie is, it's a character in a film. We know that Charlton Heston was the president of the NRA for a while. We also know that, and even Michael Moore said this later, I shouldn't have done the sabotage job I did on him.
Did he say that?
Yeah, well, I mean, I heard he was saying it was like, I kind of wish maybe I hadn't have said that because, or hadn't have done that with him because I did not realize he was in the early stages of Alzheimer's.
Yeah.
Because it's like people were like saying, well, maybe he's a racist, all kind of stuff, forgetting that he marched with Martin Luther King and a bunch of other people.
Yes.
You know, because he believed it was the right thing to do. So that's a load of crap. He was a guy, I'm not a gun person. He is a gun person, but I don't think that him. It's like looking at Ronald Reagan nowadays and saying, I don't think he'd know his Republican Party. It's like looking at Charlton Heston going, I don't think he'd know this NRA.
Yeah.
It's like, this is a guy that wanted his hunting rifles and guns in the house to protect himself if somebody broke in.
Yeah.
That's the kind of person he was. He wasn't there with the super weapons. And people jam that to him nowadays and everything. And somebody said the other day, well, you know, Will Smith's portrayal is so much more sensitive than Charlton Heston's bloodthirsty version. And I'm like,
Well,
I mean, you know, and I know that he was the head of the Academy for a while, but I never saw him smack somebody in the face, a defenseless person on the face in front of millions of people.
Ooh.
You know what I'm saying? I mean, I'm just like, it's just like, I think that I am not a gun person and I'm not very religious, but I'm going to say this. I think that I love Charlton Heston for the entertainment. I mean, I think he was a pretty decent guy.
Yeah,
there's things I disagree with him on, but I still look at this guy and go, I love that guy. I love his movies. I think he was a good man, you know, and everything. And so, but I think people look at this character in the film and they try to equate it with something that he did when he got home.
Yes. And then even Michael Moore, I mean, uses clips from Omega Man in his Bowling for Columbine film. And it's like Charlton Heston, the head of the NRA, and it's him machine gunning the family.
Yeah,
I'm like, guys,
that's easy to do that. Yeah.
What an easy, cheap shot.
But one thing,
but, go ahead.
I just wanted to finish that thought, what I was talking about, where his character changing and dropping the obsession. It reminded me a lot of John Wayne in The Searchers, where you had this person with his obsessed with bigotry and so on
going on.
And here he was able to change at the end. And I think he's one of the, he might be the only character that has any kind of arc, you know, where you see the change go through it because it's his movie. And it was a big thing to show that he was going to pull back. And if they wouldn't have, if Richie would not have gone to the family, the ending would have been totally different, you know, because he was ready. He was like, okay, they're all dying out anyway. We already established that the family, the plague is going to take them out. It's all a matter of time. And I can see where Richie's coming from. They're still humans too. And, you know, and I can understand that, but you got to save those you can't
save. Richie didn't see the part that we saw. We saw the part where he tried to get one of Matthias's people and inject him to try to help him. And the guy was psychopathic. So Richie is right in a way, but he's a good guy. He's a good kid, but he didn't see this. I mean, Heston was already trying to do that earlier. And now Heston goes, look, I'm just washing my hands of this because this is just going to get us killed. I'm getting out of here. Life is good. Richie's doing better. Rosalind Cash is now my girlfriend, you know. Rosalind Cash has to deal with the fact that she's, sucking face with Moses, and stuff like that. I mean, it's one of those things. I heard originally that,
Diane Carroll. Diane Carroll to play the role.
I think Rosalind Cash was, I mean, I love Diane Carroll. I used to watch Julia when it was brand new. That's how old I am. But I love that show, and I loved her on it. But she was a little too nice. Rosalind Cash was just right.
Your name's Mud. Like, oh, snap. If you just want to play James Bond, I'll bust your ass. It's like, oh, snap.
Got any more questions, fathead? Ooh, getting rough there.
Oh, I know. Ooh.
But I mean, she was great. It's a kitschy movie. This is one thing we got to talk about this film. The movie starts off, guys, in this giant, giant red convertible, tooling around, gobbling up gas, playing music, shooting at shadows on the walls, goes to the theater, puts on Woodstock that he's been watching for 3 years and can quote the thing all the way through. He's got his darn hunting safari looking sort of jacket on, and his little toupee and his pilot's glasses. And he's driving around with his burp gun, going all over town and all that. And you've got Rosalind Cash with her giant afro. She's beautiful. She's like right out of a blaxploitation film. She's wonderful, but she's got a heart. And then I love Paul Coslow as Dutch, the biker hippie guy who really is just a medical student who's, got the whole leather jacket. I remember when they showed it on NBC, anytime they showed Dutch, when it got close to seeing that jacket with that bird, it would cut real quick. And then I said, was that a big red bird? It was just enough of it. You could see it, but then it would
cut away.
Yeah. Then I saw it on like Turner Classic Movies and I'm like, I have this big red bird.
Yep.
But, or it was probably a VHS from a rental place, but, it was all really cool. I mean, it was the fashion and everything. And given the fact that science fiction nowadays, and this is sort of like me with Steven coming up with a reason for why the 8-track tape was the way it was, is me coming up with we have so many science fiction stories now that deal with multiple timelines and multiple universes. Mm. And in other words, this is sort of like, yes, we're already past the 1972 to 75 biohazard destruction of the Earth and all that. But in another reality, this happened. Now, that might be me trying to help the film along too much, but I don't care. When I go in here, I put on my 1970s glasses when I watch this film. The music is wonderful. The editing is wonderful. The passion is wonderful. Charlton Heston, I think Joshua and I've talked about this before. To me, there's two kind of actors. There's kind of the method type. There's the Dustin Hoffmans and the Gary Oldmans and the Brandos, and then there and the Paul Newmans. There's the actors that hand everything to you, and I think it's one of the reasons. And people have scoffed at what I've said before, but there's a reason that people like, while they're still working, that people like Charlton Heston and William Shatner are so popular, and some people really rag on them. And, this is my, as far as I'm concerned, Dutch is the only answer I've got for you guys, is that Heston, kids could watch Charlton Heston movies. I mean, like 7 and 8 year olds and love his movies. They couldn't watch The Graduate or Hud, which are fantastic movies. They're superb films, but Charlton Heston is one of those guys that goes, I'm going to tell you everything. You're going to know what I'm thinking. You're going to know when I'm happy. You're going to know when I'm hurt. Shatner, the same thing. Here it is. This is, I'm giving you all this information. And people kind of poo-poo that. But to me, it's like, I mean, we ate it up as kids. And, I watch Airport 75 when Karen Black's pulling the plane, away from hitting the mountain. And Chuck goes,
cry, baby.
Cry. And I'm like, okay, Chuck. And I think that was, wasn't that directed by Boris Segal? No, that was directed by the guy that did Frankenstein, the true story. I forget. That's right.
Is it really?
I think so. It's yeah. But you know, still, I mean, Chuck is as big as the universes that he inhabits. So is Shatner. Gary Oldman is one of those guys that is a very regular human being, or Richard Dreyfuss in like I said, in Close Encounters. They're regular guys that are having all this stuff, and we're watching them react to it, and they're fantastic. But every once in a while, you need a hero. You need somebody who's really big. You need a movie star type person. And people, you know, call it bad acting. I say, it's just different. Just different. Thank you.
Josh, stacking on that, Charlton Heston is one of your favorites, you know, actors of all time.
I can't stand him.
Well, which we just heard Mark just totally diss him, you know, and all this other stuff. But Josh, what are some things that you love about Charlton Heston? Because this episode is coming out on his 100th birthday, so you can.
Yes. Well, I mean, Mark kind of took all the steam out of my argument, so I got nothing to add. But no, I find so much enjoyment every film, and there's still some that I have yet. I'm trying to save up his filmography. There's some that I haven't, like The Mountain Men. I haven't seen The Mountain Men. Some gems that I'm like, I need to save onto those because there's only a limited supply of Charlton Heston movies. But I don't know if maybe you guys can attest to it. Mark, you can just growing up with him, and he reminds me of my dad in a way. My image of, you know, masculine man, and he, like you said, Mark, he's the hero, and he's going to, you know, be the hero. And I people can knock him because one of my friends was like, "Well, you know what you're going to get when you watch a John Wayne movie," and I was like, "Yeah, but isn't
they're
that
really
part
good?
Of fun? Yeah, they're great.
A lot of them are really good. I don't. Yeah, that's that whole thing." It's we're dealing a little bit with the woke movement that attacks anything. I had one guy, somebody was talking about The Searchers, which I think is, if it isn't the single best Western of all time, it's in those top two or three to me. I think it's a freaking, I hated Westerns, hated them. And then one day my dad and I are sitting there on Turner on Saturday morning, channel 17 out of Atlanta. The Searchers comes on and I'm like, okay, I'll watch it. You know, it's got the singing guy at the beginning during the credits. Oh boy. And I start watching it, and I'm like, it's kind of good. You know, this is really pretty. And by the time the end of the films are, that was pretty good. And I started watching, not a bunch at first, but I started watching Westerns here and there because that movie is so great. Well, on Facebook, our favorite place to get people irritated for trolls.
Of course.
Somebody said, you know, John Wayne was racist. And I'm like, And I came up with a thing, and I went, so were your parents at that same time, or your grandparents. So was everybody. Mm. The level at which everybody was thinking at that time, you can't just hand it to John Wayne. It was to society at that time. And that's the thing that's driving me nuts. I believe everybody should get along. I think we should, like Gene Roddenberry said, take a positive delight in everybody's differences. But don't sit here and single out somebody and this, that, and the other and go, that person's a racist or this, that, or the other. When pretty much everybody went along with that. That guy at the time was a hero. So, you know. And it's like, once again, what we had talked about with Chuck and the things that he did in his time period.
Yes.
Now, I'll say one thing about Charlton Heston. We talk about the idea of him being a man or masculine. Is that it was a real masculinity. It isn't that fake, like, I'm trying to think of something. There were actors in movies, and I won't name names, where macho is just oozing off of them. As a matter of fact, that is their function for being around. Talk like this is all about. It's all about fighting and being sweaty and killing, and it's like, you got any hobbies?
You got any personality here?
You like puzzles or anything? You know, I mean, there's nothing like that. And that's the thing, is that the guys that were considered, you know, tough back then, they still were regular kind of guys to me. But then we got this comic booky, cartoony sort of thing. Vin Diesel. And I just sort of and that ilk where it's all about this persona. Yes. That's your whole life. It's like, I feel bad for you, but nobody believes that. People don't function that macho or that masculine all the time. It's just, and so to me, you look at John Wayne, or you look at Gregory Peck, or you look at Robert Mitchum, or you look at, and they're, and yeah, they're pretty tough. Burt Lancaster, yeah. Pretty tough guys, but they will sit there and get into the day-to-day minutiae of being a regular human being. And I mean, we're in a day and age now where, and I'm not talking about specifically about comic films like Marvel, but that we're in a thing where almost everybody is a kind of a comic book stereotype, even in films that aren't comic book. And I'm sort of like, can we get back to, you know, something like All the President's Men?
I need something. Yeah.
I mean, can we get back to the French Connection or something? Where he's not a macho guy. He's a, you know, he's a kind of a scumbag is what he is. And Steve McQueen in Bullet. He's not macho. He's just very quiet.
Mm-hmm. He just wants to go back to bed.
Yeah, really.
He's like, do we have to do this?
I was like, oh my God, I haven't seen one of those little things that you put in the coffee cup in years. My mom used to have one, so I immediately went on up on Amazon and bought one.
Oh, great.
Linda's looking at this thing, what the hell is this? You know, a thermometer?
But, I'm glad you brought up Vin Diesel, because what's Vin Diesel always say? It's all about family. And coming back to the Omega Man. How's that, Josh? Is that a segue?
Well done. That was good.
Good man. Good man.
That's a host right there. That's a host.
Is that what we're talking about? Omega Man? Oh, hey.
Oh yeah.
The family, though. I love how the look they all have, how it all works. Though I always find it weird. I'll see these synopses that people put up of one or two sentences, and it doesn't really describe the family accurately. Like, one of them was like, zombies or man eating things, and I think they're just they're getting things mixed up from other iterations of the bulk and other movies and other work, and people don't really watch the movie, but they're doing these quick little, oh, it must be about this, blah blah blah,
vampires. I wanted to ask you guys this. Do you think, I mean, because I'm comparing it, I mean, to the book and then the Vincent Price film and then this one, and this cult idea, do you think that's influenced by Manson, all that happening? And it's like, okay, let's make our villain.
It could have been a dash. There could have been a dash of that. Let's do the cult thing. This is what I heard. Somebody, and I don't remember who it was, years ago said this, and I remember reading it and thinking that, well, this is a historical authority on film, and I do not consider myself ever a historian. Anytime I remember something, I always end up misremembering it, and then I repeat it, and then everybody goes, you're wrong, because I'm an actual historian. Well, somebody said this to me, that I was wrong because it wasn't in Charlton Heston's actor's diary, an actor's life, the diary thing that he had.
Yes.
And I said, well, just because it wasn't in that doesn't mean it didn't happen. I mean, it's just a book that's like, I mean, yes, exactly. But mine's autographed.
So anyway, son of a bitch.
For those that are listening, Josh was showing the book, and Mark was of course commenting his is an autographed edition.
Good.
Being that this is an audio,
your anger.
Being that this is an audio podcast, but maybe Josh can give us a picture of him holding the book, and we can put it there with the podcast on Facebook.
Good man. So the thing is this it was another historian told me that it's not in his notes, that he read Charlton Heston's notes and it wasn't in there. It's like, well, does that mean that every single thing that was written down? Another guy who was a pretty reputable historian said that this was the story, and I'm going to relay this story to you.
Go.
That they were in the middle of working on this film. They had started, they were getting things ramped up and all that kind of stuff. And then somebody goes, well, you know, this is the version that came out like 6 years ago. And Charlton Heston goes, what? And he goes, the version that came out like six years ago or so with Vincent Price. And he goes, what do you mean the version that came out with Vincent Price? He goes, yeah, there was a version of this film came out. He goes, you're telling me I'm remaking a film that Vincent Price made like 6-7 years ago? They go, Vincent Price is a friend of mine. And now you're telling me I'm remaking his film? And they were like, yeah, I guess so. And he goes, And so he like was like, oh, this is what? What is this? So they decided to make some of those changes based on the fact they didn't want to be like a straight up remake of what Vincent Price had made. Because
really?
Now that's what I heard. That is from a guy. I don't remember which one it was. And people are like, yeah, Mark, you're pulling it out of your backside. But I mean, I didn't come up with this.
Yeah, yeah.
I heard it.
I mean, I heard it from somebody. I wouldn't have come, you know. And it was one of those, you're saying, Steven, you saying you heard it before?
When I read something earlier, you know, doing some research for this, he had read the book on a way on an airport, and then he was thinking he wanted to make the movie, and he found that the movie had been made before. So they weren't in the middle of production. He had just read the book and was interested in doing the project. And that Joyce Corrington, one of the screenwriters, who's also has a doctorate in, I think, in the germ part, you know, something along those lines, and she wanted to make it more realistic. So as to when that screenplay part got in, because as everybody knows, screenplays can be rewritten as things are going on and that kind of stuff. So sure. It's hard to say, but I think we've heard a couple different versions, but two of those things that I think agree with what Mark said and what I've read is that he was interested in doing the project and then found out that Vincent Price had, there was a movie that he had done earlier. So obviously then they were going to make alterations. Now as to whether it happened pre-production or during production, you know, or where that happened during the stage.
Somewhere along the time it happened. And then we put in the scene where Moses kills Bacchus, you know, just, you know, but
yeah,
no, but,
we'll
you,
bring
but, death, but you see, but you see what I'm saying is that yes. It was sort of like, we can't literally just remake it. I'm going to say something a little, go back the other direction a little bit. And I have no problem with, you know, the Vincent Price version. I've watched it a few times. It's fine. I don't dislike it. I need to watch it again, actually, now that it's been restored. I think I watched really bad copies of it. But the whole vampire thing, you know, some people are like, oh, I don't like this now because it's no longer vampires, it's mutants. To me, it's sort of, I don't have a problem with this. I really
don't either.
I mean, it's just sort of, it's neat. I can see the transition easier over to just some kind of new messed up sort of being created. And here comes a part that's going to probably make some people irritated. I'm not a big fan of the ending, and I've talked to a lot of people that feel the same way. I'm not a big fan of the ending of the book. I am not a big fan.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not a big fan. The guy goes, oh, now I'm the one. And this is Richard Matheson was a massively great concept, coming up with concept. But I noticed that some of my favorite stories that he did that like Rod Serling would go and then redo for Twilight Zone.
Yeah.
Rod Serling would put that O. Henry punch ending to it.
Yeah.
Richard was like, here's a great concept. And Rod goes, great, 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 great. Okay. You're tired. You just sit over there for a little bit. Like the one where the woman's talking to her dead husband on the phone and
it turns, and
Serling put in that whole line across the tombstone at the end. I thought that was
really,
so, well, I mean, it was, I read the original story and that doesn't happen.
Really?
Not in the story. And I was kind of like, this is
kind of lame,
but still, I mean, if I had never seen the Twilight Zone episode and then read the story by itself, it'd be great. But it was like one of the things I said about Michael Crichton with Jurassic Park. People get mad about the ending of Spielberg's Jurassic Park with all the dinosaurs going at each other and all stuff. But in the end of the Crichton book, once again, a great concept guy. But at the end, the velociraptors get killed by injecting poison into eggs and rolling them to them. And it's sort of like, and then the army shows up and it's like, oh, we're going to clean up now. And you don't even see what happens.
Lame.
There's people that sort of like at the ending of Jaws, in the book, the shark gets away. At the end, he gets blown up because he's got an air tank in his mouth.
Yeah, yeah.
Some people take the ball or take the baton and they run with it. Now, I'm not saying that they're better or anything. It's just got more punch for you know. And so Matheson, I've read a bunch of his stuff. I've read a lot of his short stories. He's wonderful. He's fantastic. But I've talked to several people that at the end of the story, the guy just feels like, oh, this is the way mankind's supposed to go. And he decides he's going to off himself. And he commits suicide. And to me, that's a real kind of a, I don't say it's a lame ending. That's not fair. But
it's a lame ending.
he needs to sit there, and it's like, you know, I'm sorry there's no psychiatrist for you to go see in the world because they're all gone. But one of them would sit down and try to give you a pep talk and tell you, hey, you need to keep going.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. At the end of this film, he's got his art. He's got his, the stuff he's stolen from the gallery. He hadn't stolen it because there's nobody left. So technically, he's probably preserving it. These beautiful statues and paintings. There's a Van Gogh on the wall. Beautiful busts of, Roman people and all that stuff. And the house is fantastic. And he plays music and he dresses up on Sundays and all that stuff. And he's trying to preserve some of the beautiful aspects of humanity. And at the end, during this very sad part where it looks like their lives are going to be great, they're going to go away. He's willing to say, to heck with Matthias. I don't care where he is. We're leaving. I've got love. There's children involved with this that we've got to take care of. We're going to build the world again. We're going to go out to the Sierras or wherever it was he said. And we'll bring the biker with us. And he is happy. And then it's just the wrong day. Because Richie goes out and does what he does, and his girlfriend, who you could tell earlier, there's a scene that she's nude earlier. She has to pull the curtains, and you start to, she's starting to get sensitive to light. I didn't notice it because I was too busy looking at her naked.
But never noticed that. Wow, that's a great point.
Could you open those curtains back up and get a little more light?
Yeah.
No, but anyway, so she and they sure as heck didn't show that on NBC. And it looks and the music by Ron Grainer, there's this music at that point. It's I want to actually hum it for you guys, and then people who are listening to the podcast go, oh boy, what a loser. But it's this almost autumn sort of music.
Well said.
And everything and things are starting to calm down, but there's a bittersweet thing. And then things go bad. Richie goes and sees the family gets killed, and then Rosalind Cash turns. She does look pretty hot with that white afro and the blue eyes and all that. She's pretty cool. But anyway, and then she comes home. She comes back to the house. He goes on a Heston's trying to get home and kills a bunch of guys. An action sequence with that dang Jeep that I love.
I love that freaking Jeep.
Rednecks have killed that. I mean, it's like, and go hunt some kangaroo or something, but it's like he's got the blue jumpsuit, he's got the Air Force cap, he's got the burp gun, he's got the bombs and all that kind of stuff. He gets into a fight with the fan. There's one part we just say it's just sort of lazily just sprays the all that kind of stuff. You know,
well that's my favorite part where he sees Richie and he's like, oh my god, and then it's. And then it's the jump.
I can't. There's not enough. I can't get in that.
I bought it. The jump cut right to the Jeep hurtling down the street, and the music is going bam, 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 bam. And every time that happens, I don't know wherever I'm at, I'm just like, yeah, let's go!
Do it, Chuck!
Fucking go!
Oh, kill the family!
Yeah.
Kill Charles Manson!
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, and then he gets to the house, and this is the part that, once again, it's almost been like positive reinforcement has been replayed hundreds of times just on audio alone, let alone the DVDs, Blu-rays, HBO Max, whatever the hell it's called now, where he gets home and he's sad because he's got to tell his girlfriend that her brother is dead.
Yeah.
And she goes, I know. And then she comes around the corner and everybody's in the house and they the music starts to build up. And then they destroy everything in the house, all the art, and they slash the paintings, and they blow up his giant narcissistic TV set that he could keep an eye on everything with. And, there's a bit of an action-y sequence where he gets away and he goes down, grabs Lisa and runs down the stairs. And when he gets down there and 10 minutes to set up, damn, we'll have to chance it.
We'll have to chance it.
Charlton Heston, who always in every film has his wristwatch facing off of his wrist, always looks. I did that for years. You know, it's like, ah. And so he goes out, and there's that beautiful. I hear that somebody told me about that darn fountain. I think it's still out someplace or whatever. Me and Josh need to go steal it. The only thing is, we'd shoot each other over whose house it goes
who's
to.
Who's going to? Yeah, exactly.
Who's take it home.
I heard that it's the Friends fountain. Is that true? Like in the,
I'm not a
Friends fan at all. But,
me neither. I've never.
But apparently, in the intro, they're all sitting on the couch, and there's a fountain behind it. Apparently, that's the same. And like in the house behind it.
Oh, now I'm gonna have to watch Friends.
I know.
Holy crap! But he sits there and he goes, you know, he runs out, and this is the thing. Earlier in the film, a spear got dropped by the one of the family members who was going up there to kill him.
Brother Zachary.
He's up there in that hunky paradise, brother. So anyway, it's still sitting up there from when Heston killed him earlier. And then Anthony Zerbe reaches down. I've heard Zerb, but the guy on Turner Classic Movie said Zerbe, so I'm going to go with Zerbe.
And he
picks it up and he throws it, and Heston's messing with the machine gun, and he goes, damn it, jammed. And then, you know.
It's such a thick hit. It just like
it hits
like someone.
And it doesn't do that rubbery thing too. It doesn't like Emily Oz perfect. And then it hits him, and then he falls into the pool, and he pulls it out, and the blood's gushing out because we're now in a PG rated 1970s film. And
you're evil.
She's turning, and he's trying to, you know. And
I'm part of the family.
Family now, the family, Robert. You don't understand.
But anyone, any friend who is Lisa, anytime I see him, it's Lisa. Every time I see him, Lisa.
Steven, this is the time. This is the last episode of your show because people are just like
they're tuning
it's
out.
Over,
no
man.
One's listening.
It's
to
over,
this.
Man.
No.
So anyway, then he's there, and then you know, and then the kids. It switches to the next morning. It fades out from you know Heston bleeding all over the place and her unconscious on the ground. And then, you know, and on the farm, he had some ducks. With the Land Rover, the hippies bringing them into town, the little kids that they found. And Heston's there and Dutch shows up and he sees him. He reaches into his chair. Thank God the spear didn't hit the bottle.
The
serum that he's been working on to save humanity. And he almost drops it. Dutch grabs it. And then it goes to this thing a lot of people have pointed out. And when I was a kid, I didn't think anything of it. But now I get a lot more that Heston, you know, they take Lisa and they put her in the Land Rover with the kids and they're going to go away. And Heston sort of, you know, he almost looks at him like for a second, like, is there anything I can do? And then Heston just collapses.
Yeah.
And then it goes to this almost sort of like, and people, I remember I heard the two different versions of the music because I got both of those soundtracks that were put out by FSM. I bought the original one, which skyrocketed to $500 at one point on eBay. And they got so mad at Film Score Monthly that they did Omega Man 2.0 Unlimited or something was the name of it.
Yeah.
And so they're like, you know, because we're not doing this anymore. And I'm like, well, okay, good. So I bought it too. It actually had a few different things, but the original one had the kids singing the songs.
Oh, and that's what we need. That's what we want on the soundtrack, really. That's
I think we should sing that at every convention.
That's how the episode should start. That's it.
You and I should just be outside in front of a convention going, and on this farm, loser, loser, loser. So, you know, but at the end, he collapses in this sort of almost like crucifix sort of pose, Jesus sort of pose, and everything. And some people are like, oh, that's a little bit silly or something. But it's like, you know, it's kind of true. The guy in the end ultimately is the savior of this new world.
Well, and it's that and the Dutch holds it's one of my favorite shots. He holds the serum, and it's just him on, you know, close up, and then the kids are lined up in the back just looking at him. And I was like, what a cool, you know, this is going to be the future of humanity. What a great thing. But he's in the fountain, and it's kind of Christ-like. And even when they're going to burn him at Is this not the place where all the dead were buried in the stadium? He's tied up, and it's kind of like a Christ-like thing, too. So I'm like, ah, okay.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. There's an earlier part in the film where they grab Neville, they dump a big wine rack on him, and then jump up and down on him for a little while. And then
that's how you get him.
They tell him, and I will say this. One thing I really like about this movie, and the laughs were pretty good. Nowadays, people go, but back at the time, the laughs landed pretty solid. It was almost these Mad Magazine type commentary things that Heston said. You guys really with the IRS, you know, or whatever, you know. I mean, or when Lisa later goes, you know, well, Dutch showed up and said he was with the census, you know. I mean, things like that were actually pretty funny, but I could actually see that crap in a Mad Magazine.
That's
pretty good. You know, or him, you know, Neville runs the many minute mile. I mean, I'd like to see some son of a bitch
beat that,
you know, and it's like. You know, it was actually pretty funny, but there's the scene where the family grabs him early and they take him out to the football stadium to burn him alive. I guess it must have been the Super Bowl, and they took him out there. But the thing is, I love this about Heston. You talk about somebody being macho or whatever, but he had the dunce cap on.
Yeah,
and what I like about that, it's like he's not, no, I'm too cool for that. Just make sure that my toupee is quaffed and
yeah,
you know, and all that kind of stuff. And it's like, no, they look at you as a fool, a dunce, an idiot, and everything. And they stick the thing on him, and they go to burn him. The music at that point is fantastic too. Ron Grainer. I always get really silly with that when that piece of music, when I play it, I always somehow manage to work in Jesus Christ Superstar because it's so close. There's a bit of a closeness to you know, Jesus Christ, but. I'm trying to think of what else we haven't talked about. I mean, there's things about him going home, and then
hold on for a second. There's one thing I wanted to bring up to tie in with what you've been talking about.
Sure.
With actors, you know, like with Charlton Heston and things like that, and how people have to show the macho-ness nowadays since the 80s, you know, when they had the big action heroes and all that stuff. When I look at it, is you have these guys that they know they're king. If you know, if you're king, you don't have to tell everybody, hey, I'm the king. And Charlton Heston, exactly. John Wayne, Kirk Douglas, these people that we've been talking about, they know who they are as a person, sure. As an actor, and what they're going to portray. They don't have to keep doing these certain tricks, you know, I'm Batman, you know, whatever, you know, kind of stuff to make it like they're like tougher than they are. And I think that's the thing that's missing with a lot of cinema in the last 10, 20 years is that you really don't have any actors, very few actors that it used to be back in the day when we were watching movies and TV shows, and you can have somebody, a comedian, do a little sketch, and you know right away, oh, they're doing Humphrey Bogart. Oh, they're doing, you know, Charlton Heston. Yeah. They're doing John Wayne. And, I mean, I remember watching Scooby-Doo, Where Are You? Where the episode where Scooby-Doo is told to be brave, like, be like John Wayne. He goes, John Wayne? And he starts walking like John. And everybody got it. You know, it was set up for kids.
Because,
but, I mean, here it was. It just. But now if you said to somebody, hey, you're Gary Oldman, nobody's going to know, or Brad Pitt, nobody's going to know who the heck you're talking about, you know, if you're doing a kid, because they're all chameleon actors, which is not saying there's wrong with their acting. It's just different.
No. I mean, I think Brad Pitt has done some phenomenal acting. I actually am a big fan. I mean, you look at him being when he decides to be weird or something, he can really, like, California, the one with the K or whatever.
He's a wonderful actor, but I'm just saying is if you told somebody to do a character draw of him, they would have no idea what to do.
Here's my thing. Here's my thing with somebody like Humphrey Bogart. If you complete, nobody had ever heard of Humphrey Bogart. Nobody had ever seen him. And somebody goes, next on the Andy Griffith Show, Don Knotts, what was the character's name? Barney?
Barney Fife.
Barney Fife. Barney. Barney's brother shows up, and it's played by Humphrey Bogart. They look alike. That's the thing with Bogart. Bogart's personality outweighed his looks. He's the coolest dude ever. In Casablanca, in The Big Sleep, but he's not good looking. It's that personality. And yet he looks a little bit, he doesn't look exactly like that, but there's that same sort of face. And yet, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And it's about personality.
He's got personality.
Lists with personality. Kills people with personality.
No, said. That's a great analogy. That's nice.
Go ahead.
I wanted to throw some stuff to Josh because I feel like it's mostly Mark and I talking, and I feel Josh isn't really good.
I'm enjoying this. You're preaching to the choir.
That's Stephen's way of saying I'm mostly talking, but but I am.
But it is true. Josh, the cinematography and the directing style. Yeah. If you can be being the filmmaker, because I know Mark has a great eye as an artist and things like that. I'm a film enthusiast, but you're the one. Walk us through some of the stuff, because you did homages of this with the Alpha Omega Man. So I know you were paying attention to the different shots when you were doing that 2016 student project, you know, type thing, which is still available where, Josh?
It's on YouTube for free because I couldn't do the Omega Man without using Ron Grainer's score. That's what flagged me. I was like, I don't care. We got to use it. That's half the reason I did it.
Good man.
Talk about the cinematography and the directing and what you thought of it.
I think it's a wonderful, I watched it this morning, trying to imagine not watching it because it's such a part. I mean, Mark and I, we were quoting this up the butt. I mean, we know this film like the back of our head. And I tried to watch it as someone who'd never seen it before, didn't know anything going in. And what a cool way to just, the opening, just him driving around listening to Frank Sinatra that's not Frank Sinatra. And you're just, for someone who doesn't know what's going on, it's like, okay, wait, huh? He's in LA and he's just smiling his Chuck smile. And I thought it was an excellent way to slowly, you didn't have the crawl at the beginning. Mankind has been wiped out by something. If it's a screenplay or director or a mix of both, just giving us little pieces throughout. And as a viewer, I think that's wonderful because we're like, okay, wait, is this, you know, this is LA, obviously, where is everyone? And even he's watching Woodstock and you're like, okay, where is everyone? And then wait, oh, they're going to be up. You know, the sun's already set. They'll be everywhere. And you're like, wait, who is he talking about? And then we get the family. And it's only until, I guess, when he pushes the button in the elevator, we get a little bit of a flashback, but not completely. And it's like he presses the button and we see the warheads going off and explosion.
The backboard.
Yeah.
Well, the thing is, though, is you do know something's weird by the fact that he slams on the brakes of the car and machine guns that.
And the machine guns,
Something's not right. You're not seeing anybody, and the one person that he sees, or the one we think it's a person, he tries to kill.
Yes.
So something's going on. We're just not privy to it yet.
And I just, from a filmmaking standpoint, I'm like, what a great way to just start your film, and you don't need... In the beginning, there was that. And then finally, when we get the family, and then it cuts to Matthias, and he's the newscaster, which I think is such a great idea. I was like, of course he would be the head. Everyone knew him if he was like the Walter Cronkite at the time. It's like, of course he would lead the family. Everyone
exactly.
was that. I
exactly.
love that. Two random filmmaking things that I caught. There's a montage of everyone dying from the plague. And it's like, it's the, but there's the people like, and the guy on the street, and he's just like, ah, and it's like a handheld shot. And you see other people on the street just like looking at them with the weirdest, like, what the hell is, are they shooting a movie? And it's the extras that are hired on the street that are like holding their mouths and choking and stuff. But then there's other people. If you like pause again with the magic of Blu-ray, you pause and you see like, there's one lady who's just like looking at them. It's like, wait, are they for real? Is this, what is going on here? That's a great thing. And then to go back to Chuck again, I mean, happy 100th birthday. How much of a reading his diaries and stuff, how much of a, it was the work was what he got the joy out of. I mean, he wasn't the macho man. He was here to tell the story and do it right and let's do it. I mean, there's the famous story of Earthquake, that he changed the ending of Earthquake because he didn't think that he should run off with Genevieve Bujold.
Yeah, Bujold, right.
Yeah, yeah. He was like, no, I need to go down and let's change it. That's a better story. But this is, again, how many times I've seen this freaking movie. He's one of the early scenes. He's back into his house. He just had the fire. He shot some people in the family, and he is unchaining, unlocking the generator. The generator is in this kind of like cage thing for protection. And there's three padlocks, and he's unlocking each one, and it's a very deliberate shot. He unlocks the top one, unlocks the middle one, and then he goes to the third one, and he unlocks it, and he's trying to hook it onto the grating, and it's not working, and the camera pans up, and he subtly just like puts it into his hand and opens the door, and then he puts it in his pocket. And me, from a directing standpoint, I'm like, Chuck, you son of a bitch, you just saved a take. Instead of saying, it's not hooking onto the thing, can we do another take? It's like, what a masterful artist of just like this. And you seen it 400 times, you would never even notice, but my eye.
And it's funny, today like too, I was watching that specific scene, and I'm like, first line.
Yeah, second lock. Very deliberate. Lock.
It's like we're wondering, why is it locked up this well?
Yes.
Because just in case the family gets in, mm-hmm. you know. And I did not even see him pocket the third one. So
it's
very
so
good.
Subtle. It's so sweet. I mean, of course, Chuck, but the artistry or the artist behind it was like, I'm not going to, this is a long take. We don't need to set up again. We probably have a low budget. We don't have that much time. I'm just going to pocket it. The take is good. No one's going to notice.
And I saw like, that, Josh, but I thought he was always putting the key in his pocket. And I was just like, now you got me wondering if it was the lock.
Smart. Yeah.
Anyway, my two cents.
I will say this, you know, you're talking about the scene in the, he leaves Woodstock, the movie. He looks up and the sun is starting to get low. And then all of a sudden he has that sort of like, I haven't heard anybody or seen anybody for years, so I'm a little mental. And then the thing about the phones ringing, all the phones in the, not phone booths. What do they call them? Phone. What are they like? They're not phone booths. They're sort of like phone stalls or something now.
Yeah.
And then, you know, they're all, he's getting all this ringing. And, oh, there's no phone ringing. Damn it. And then he looks up again and now the sun's lower. And then he goes, oh my God, they'll be waking up soon. And then he jumps in the car and he takes off and he crashes through a bunch of stuff. And he gets home, but they laid a trap for him, and one of them pours a bucket of gasoline, and they light it on fire, and he shoots a guy on the car, and a couple of them are on the car, one's on the car, and he drives into the garage with the automatic door. As it's closing, it slams into the wall. The guy goes up against it, and Heston machine guns him. Two other guys have come in behind him. These are family members with their long cowls and everything, and he machine guns them. Now, you were six, didn't you say, when you saw six or seven when you saw this?
Yeah.
I showed this to my son when he was that same age, and I had to stop the film. When he saw the guys getting hit, when the blood packs exploded.
Really?
Yeah. It was one of those things where I watched him three or four times go through what I call my Quatermass in the Pit moment, where I lost it with Colonel Breen melting.
Yeah.
Where I didn't talk for a day in 1967.
Is that right?
Oh, I lost it. I actually talked to Julian Glover about it later. I said, hey,
no,
you know,
way.
You melted in Quatermass in the Pit, and then I couldn't talk. And then decades later, I took my girlfriend and her mom to see Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, and you drank from the wrong cup, and you melted again, and the mom lost her crap. And then he just looked at me as he was getting his glass of wine from the bar, and he goes, and yet I'm still here. And then he just walked off. But the thing is that I watched my son, and he does this thing where he shudders when something really is disturbing. And so I turned it off, you know, and all that kind of stuff. And then he watched it later. You know, you get a little older and everything.
Yeah. That's
but they like it. I mean, they both think, you know, they both love the Omega Man, but it's one of those where, you know, certain times when you're got an innocent mind, things can shatter things. I've seen things as a little kid. Bruce Dern getting his hand cut off in Charlotte. And I lost my mind over that. It was horribly shocking that would be the beginning of a film. This movie is once again, that PG that would almost be R nowadays.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
People don't think of it that way. It has nudity. You don't see any PG or PG-13 film with nudity nowadays.
Yeah.
We used to see PG. PG films had some nudity. Some films would have a little bit of nudity in them.
Mm-hmm.
Violence, yeah, maybe so, but movies were in the 70s were more edgy. They were more raw. They were more gritty.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it goes what you said about the comic booky cliche characters now. It's like, let's get back to our 70s. You know, there's levels here and there's gritty and nitty. And
I watch movies from that time period and I go, boy, man, the people from like the late 60s into the mid 70s really had it going on. When a movie was rated R, it was for a reason. Mm-hmm. It was for a reason.
You guys brought up freaking Airport was G on the podcast. I've never even thought of that. I'm like, whoa!
Most things would have been rated G until they just got a little bit out there. I mean, things like Dr. Fives. I like this film, even though a lot of people tell me I'm, you know, full of crap, Night of the Lepus.
But hell yeah.
But there is some pretty gory moments, like when that one guy gets attacked, he's got blood all over him,
and there's some
guts on a person or anything. And it's that's the PG thing, but Airport, you know, there's nothing really in there.
It's like adult themes, though. I'm like, wow.
It was adult themes nowadays that we get a PG maybe or something. But but you're talking to a guy who one morning was sitting there eating a bowl of heated spaghetti like at 8 o'clock in the morning where I heard my neighbor's cars going off to go to church. And I'm sitting there eating this bowl of spaghetti, watching The Exorcist. And then I look up and go, wait a minute, what's wrong with this? I'm watching The Exorcist at 8 o'clock in the morning on a Sunday morning, eating spaghetti. And my neighbors are leaving to go to church.
You are living, you are fulfilling your destiny.
My world is different from yours. No, but you know, I mean, we're cinephiles, we're cinates. We love this stuff, you know?
Before I forget, go ahead. No, I'm sorry.
Oh, no.
Go ahead.
You first, Josh.
Just a real quick story before I forget. There was a blizzard. I was up in New York. This was year two of New York, and there was a huge blizzard that was coming to the town. And the whole city shut down because they had a really terrible blizzard the year before. And so they're taking they're taking all the precautions. And so they shut down the city from like midnight to 6 a.m. No cars were allowed on the street. And so I was doing the Vesuvius experiment at the time, very Quatermassy, man turning into a crab loose in New York City. And I was like, wouldn't it be great to get empty shots of Times Square with snow coming down? And I can make it part of the movie where the crab man is loose, so everyone is in lockdown. And so I'm walking in the mid, there's no one out. It's snow is coming down. And I walk the 3 miles from downtown to Times Square, but I'm in the middle of the street and the wind is blowing. And it's echoing through the buildings, and just out of nowhere, I'm just like, Matthias! And it echoed just like the movie. Matthias! I was like, whoa, Matthias, cool, Matthias.
Yeah.
So anyway, just had to bring that up.
I was watching a cop show a couple of months ago with my girlfriend, and it was like it's that one that's that big square building that's got the water around it that, you know, he's jogging in front of, and I go,
oh, yes.
I'm the Omega Man! Because I got no life.
Yeah.
Now, what I wanted to bring up was something interesting that Lisa brought up as a character thing. And it makes me wonder, because also with the phones ringing and of course, Neville having to remind himself, this isn't real, this isn't real. How sane was he? Because Lisa brought up about how they knew about him. They knew he was there and how he would shoot at anybody that moved. So makes you wonder, when you see that shadow of that thing early on, was that the family? Because the family would have been sleeping, or was it somebody that was still not the part of the family? Like we saw the children, and we saw Lisa, and we saw Dutch. There could have been other people, and it makes you wonder if at other times he might have inadvertently, because he saw movement in that, you know, that fight flight type thing, and might have accidentally shot people that were not turned.
It looked like a family silhouette in hindsight.
No. I'm not talking about that particular scene. I'm saying in other for those 2 years because Lisa and them were scared of him because he shot at anything that moved. And so I'm thinking, could this been not something that was filmed, but could have been something that, and then just because we saw, we also heard the phone ringing. So that, you know, just because we saw that image looking like the family doesn't mean that was reliable. If we could hear the phone ringing and, you know, hear his reaction,
I think they did that on purpose. They did that on purpose so that when later he goes into the Von Trapp family house that's been redecorated as a hotel, the Sound of Music house.
Is it?
I think it is.
Is it really?
Look at it again. I was watching an episode of The Green Hornet, and I go, that's the Von Trapp family. That's Captain Von Trapp's house.
Oh, well, now
and
I think
it is. It's all that white and
gold tiles and
But I'm almost positive. I'm not, you know, of course somebody some historians going like, hey man, don't know what the fuck he's talking about. but I think it is. But when he goes in and then he goes to the store and the thing falls over and he bumps up against the mannequin and starts looking at the mannequins, and this guy hasn't been with a woman in a long time.
Yeah.
And he starts to put his arm around the one and hears the noise, and then we see all these statues, and then one of them might possibly be moving a little bit. It was one of those where now that part with the phone comes into play now.
Yes.
Is he crazy? And even when she gets away,
he
still wonders if he imagined it. But
that's how it starts. Yeah, a trip to the Laughing Academy.
God, this old park bench is really putting a bunch of splinters in my back. Let's rub that old sweaty hair.
That's Chuck being Chuck.
It's funny is that it was funny because we kind of like, with this podcast, we like rushed to the end of the movie, the last 20 minutes. So now we're going back and picking up everything else, you know,
doing it in reverse.
Yeah. It's just great though. But I never get tired of, I never get tired of this movie. Never get tired of it.
Well, I enjoyed it. And one of the things I was able to, I finally own it on Blu-ray. I was able to get it for $5 at one of these, conventions.
Nice.
And it came with a bonus movie with Will Smith, which I've never seen, but it's
I think he slaps one of the family and then they leave.
One day I might watch it, but it's just, I really haven't seen the Will Smith one. I've had no desire. I have my happy spot. And I think listeners, if you haven't seen the movie, it's readily available. It's easy to find, you know, streaming, purchase wise. You definitely got to get it. And
it's one of the reasons it was one of the earliest Blu-rays available is because of the Will Smith version coming out. They were trying to capitalize on that. And that was the Blu-ray was it Blu-ray? Or was it the DVD? One of them came out and it was sort of like, Omega Man's out already without, you know, Casablanca's not even out yet. And then I realized it's like they're capitalized. It's like when the Tom Cruise War of the Worlds came out, all of a sudden George Pal's version was available.
Yeah.
Superior film.
Yeah.
And, with Omega Man, it's, you know, that's the one thing that I liked about the Will Smith film is it kind of pushed the Heston one out there a little bit more. But it's, I don't have a problem with the Vincent Price one. I don't care at all for the Will Smith one, and I love the Charlton Heston one. To me, it's easily the best, even with its not being vampires, not having the same ending as the book, and being very early 1970s style, a little blaxploitation, bit of kitsch, little bit of, you know, leisure suits the crumpled, what do you call the stuff that he wears when he's
like the ascot type thing.
The ascot thing and all that. It's Sunday. I'll be dressed up for Sunday.
I should have dressed up for this podcast. I have that costume somewhere.
Let me tell you something. She ordered me one of those. And she, it's like it came and it's like, we'll do this for Halloween about 2 years ago.
It's
the wrong color.
Well,
I was like, no,
yeah, that's
just sad. No, honey.
That's, yeah,
It was disturbing. No, yeah. But it was, she loves me. She's sweet. She's like every year, new Halloween costume that I'm so happy with. But when that came, I'm like, I think I'm just going to wear it around the house just in general. I'll probably pretend like
on Sundays,
I'll be Vincent Price from the opening of remember the old TV show Mystery when he's like a host or something.
Yeah,
I'll do something
like
that. Or Roderick Usher or something like that.
Yes,
but I'm not going to. But now, baby, you got the wrong color.
Yeah.
And I'm talking to a friend of mine who is a bit of a gun nut, and it's sort of like, how do I get a copy? And I don't even read a real gun, but I need that giant red
scope
on the top. You know. Oh, by the way, I do have a question. Let's talk about things in the movie. Let's have a little bit of fun with one. Like we said, you see people walking on the street if you look real close.
Mm-hmm.
You see a few cars here and there. You see cars in the mountains.
Yep.
They're technically the city would be a lot filthier after that amount of time. There would be foliage growing up. But there's one thing. We talked about the Sinatra tape. And we were talking about, the fact that Matthias goes, you people of technology, of oil and gas, whatever it is, the people of the wheel.
Yes.
And Chuck should have gone like, what about when you guys rolled out that catapult? What did you roll?
Was that on wheels?
Was that on, were those squares? Were you guys just dragging it along, just dragging it across the ground? I mean, you know.
But that's nothing, a great point.
Nothing
users of the wheel.
Nothing cleanses like fire.
And I love that they shoot one fireball, and then they shoot another fireball, and then they shoot one that's not even lit. I was like,
That was probably a setup. I'll tell you what. Today when I was watching it, though, the guy, there's the catapult. There's the room.
Yeah.
They light it. It fires, and it arcs, and it hits that darn window.
That,
I'm like, holy mackerel, that's pretty good. Whoever set that up did a good job.
Well done, guys. Yeah
really good. But, I mean, I don't know. I just, I can't sing the praises of this movie. If I've got two lines of films that I've got, the greatest films ever made in Mark Maddox's opinion, and then Mark Maddox's favorite movies, which this is one of those. I do not consider this one of the greatest movies ever made, but I do consider it one of my absolute favorite films, and I truly love it. I mean, I think there's a lot of nutrients in this film.
Mm-hmm.
I'll see it 1,000 more times. I have no clue as to how many times I've seen it. No clue.
I'm right there with you. I don't know if you feel the same way, Stephen, but like I can just watch this, and there'll be days where it's just like, you know what? Time to watch the Omega Man again. It's like, put it on.
It's like putting on your favorite. There's certain movies that I've got, like the 1951 version of The Thing and George Powell's War of the Worlds, George Powell's Time Machine, where you just watch them, and it's almost like putting on your favorite rock album.
Yeah.
You just put it on.
Solid.
And, yeah, they're just solid. They're, and, mm-hmm. and yeah, it's wonderful.
I enjoyed doing this both you guys. You know, and I'm glad that Josh said, hey, let's bring Mark on. I guess because Josh didn't have to worry about as much dialogue then.
No. I mean, it's so good, nice to just, I mean, live in this atmosphere and have, you know, like-minded. That's why I love Monster Bash and the convention so much, because it's like-minded, you know, individuals.
Yeah.
It's like, you like the thing too? Yeah. You know, so, yeah. So.
Right.
And I know.
Right.
I had to point out also, I don't know if you can see Chuck over there. Hold on.
Of course, ladies and gentlemen, this is an audio podcast, and he's going there to grab his picture of Chuck so we can see it, but you won't be able to see it. But Mark and I will be able to see. He's got the picture. He's put the headphones back on. Now he's going to frill us with Chuck.
We got that.
Yeah, that's the... that's
one and only.
That's the cover I did for Diabolique magazine. I was proud of that one, because I got to do something that I truly love.
It's well, I love this.
And it got on the national and international magazine stands. So Chuck with the burp gun and the blue jumpsuit and the Air Force cap and all that. The only thing that I was not able to put in there, and I kept trying to get it to work, but sometimes it's like there's a saying, I don't know if I came up with this, maybe somebody else did and I'm stealing it. But sometimes when you have all the elements you want to put in a piece of artwork from a film, you find that you can't get them all in, and sometimes you have to kill your children.
Kill the darlings. Yeah,
you have to kill the darlings. Thank you. And it's it was, and I wanted that Jeep in the background. And I wanted the Jeep with the lights and everything, and I couldn't get it to work, so I just did it. But I'm still very proud of that cover. And you know, Steven, if you want to use it for when you go to promote this podcast, I'll send you a JPEG of it so you can use it.
Yeah.
If you do that, send us the JPEG, and listeners, that way you'll be able to see it. And you can also go to Mark's Facebook page and you can, you know, look at the artwork there, reach out to him about purchasing different artwork. He's at multiple conventions like Monster Bash in the summer. And you have any conventions that are coming up in later in October? Because this will be coming out October 4th.
I've got one in the middle of October. It's down in Bartow, Florida. It's a little Star Trek convention I'm going to. They're big fans of classic Trek. I think they're going to have from Star Trek III. I think they're going to have Robin Curtis, who played Savick in Star Trek III and IV.
Cool.
But then, you know, there's other conventions starting back up as soon as convention season isn't just summer anymore. When we were young, it's sort of like, there's going to be one starting in December and then February and all that. So things are going to be hopping. And my webpage, my store is MaddoxPlanet.com. And I sell original artwork and stuff and prints. And pretty soon in the near future, I plan on taking a few days off from the hectic stuff, and I always calm down by doing either original pencils or pen and inks. And I'm going to do some Omega Man artwork. I'll do some Charlton Heston stuff, you know, with the cap and oh my God, because I just have to, you know, scratch that itch. When people see me on Facebook doing pencil stuff, 99% of the time, it's something that I wanted to see done and it hasn't become a project yet. So I just have to scratch the itch. So you'll be seeing some Omega Man stuff here in the near future.
Yeah, can't wait.
And Josh, where can people follow you so they can sign up when your Mantipus and other things are coming out?
And so I am on Facebook at Joshua Kennedy, Man of the Arts. On YouTube, I believe I'm Joshua Kennedy 1964. And I think I'm the same on Instagram. I'm getting really into hooked on Instagram. Mantipus. And if you, listening to the Omega Man, I got to plug my thesis film, The Alpha Omega Man. I mean, if you like The Omega Man, you'll find something to enjoy in that film.
Your airport film? What was your airport?
Oh, yeah. Airline 79 was my little airport tribute. So if you, the fans who appreciate, the guys who enjoy my films, those films are fans. They tend to be, you know, fans of these films, which I am. Right. I mean, at the end of the day, I'm just a fanboy wanting to. I did the Omega Man. Exactly. And it's like I get to, you know, put on the trench cut, the jumpsuit, and, you know, run around with a machine gun. That's a dream come true. But check out the Omega Man, guys, if you haven't seen it yet.
And I one other thing too I wanted to tell you about when I was a little kid, and I've got it someplace. I've told Josh this before. I actually started an Omega Man comic. It's only like one page. One page, it was like, I was almost thinking of it like a newspaper thing. One page was the Omega Man where he lives, just like I said in that story.
Yeah.
And then he comes back and he goes to Matthias's, the Civic Center, and just like starts blowing people away. And it says, and then it says at the bottom as he's machine gunning one of the family members directly in the face, it says to be continued. And then you flip it over. And on the other side is the Soylent Green comic where he lived from that too, because we didn't see him die.
That's true.
Which we should probably do that one, you and I, with Steven. But it's like it starts off with him trying to get back off on one of the garbage trucks, and he chases and he leaps back on it. I don't even remember. And then he gets inside the installation and says, to be continued, and that's about as much.
I love it.
But one of the things I wanted to say, and this was one last thing, and I know we're almost out of time here, is the sadness or the strangeness, the sadness of the director, Boris Segal. And his ending. I know you guys probably know this, right? What happened to him? He was making the TV miniseries World War III with Kris Kristofferson. And they were doing scouting. Now, he is related to Katie Segal from Married with Children. That's his daughter. and that they were he was doing scouting locations for World War III by helicopter at the, and the landing pad or whatever was at the hotel, the exterior hotel from Stanley Kubrick's The Shining.
Whoa,
so,
okay.
So the hotel that you see in The Shining is where he was leaving from to, and he was scouting and stuff. So at the end of the day, they're looking, they found a few spots where he turned around, come back, the helicopter lands. He is so busy with his paperwork, he turns around and walks into the helicopter blade in the back. And
he, I didn't know this. I did not know this.
And he dies. And it's one of those things where, to me, it makes me so sad. I couldn't believe it. It's like such a shockingly bizarre story. I feel sorry. I feel terrible for his daughter. I've always liked her. I just thought she's a great actress and a lot of fun and everything. And I love him. I love the Omega Man tremendously. And it's just so weird that it was the hotel of The Shining.
That is weird.
It's almost sort of like just spooky in a way. Well, I don't know how to put it.
Like the airport again, the plane that they used in the film, like ended up crashing in Brazil or something. Did you hear about that? Or
no, you mean from the original airport?
The film that the plane that is stuck in the snow, I believe.
Oh wow!
It was an actual plane that they filmed with it. Okay, great. And then they went back on normal service and then ended up crashing in, like, I want to say it's
Brazil.
Did
people get killed?
I think so. Like, it was some big tragedy. Oh, and it's, man, like, that's the plane from airport. But,
my God, they didn't call Joe Petroni.
Yeah.
Well,
sorry. No,
I'll have this no, mother out of here by midnight.
It's nice to know we're ending this episode on such... on such high notes, with such happiness, you know, death and destruction,
well,
and
say
despair.
Say something happy, Steven. That's your job. You're the Johnny Carson of this thing.
And here,
happy birthday, Chuck. Happy birthday, Chuck.
Josh... I was going to say, our next time you and I will be recording together, we're going to be doing Orson Welles. And you and I hadn't discussed this ahead of time. You picked the Omega Man. Is it okay if I picked the Orson Welles movie?
Please do. Please
then
do.
We're going to do F is for Fake. So listeners, the next time Josh will be on with
fake,
me.
Yeah.
F is for Fake. Man, I'm looking forward to it. I saw that movie several years ago for the first time, and I really want people to watch it. It is just a great movie. We'll talk more about
it
then.
Out.
Have you seen it, Mark?
Check it out.
Oh, you got to watch it.
No, I've heard of it. Isn't it the one with about magic acts and stuff?
Yeah, it's all about deception and filmmaking. It's, I'll tell readers right now, I'll play my hand early. It's a masterpiece to me.
Okay,
of
all right, I'll
Welles
check it out.
Type thing. It's just cool. Great. But thank you both for taking time out of your day to join me to talk about the Omega Man. And happy birthday, Charlton Heston. Happy 100th birthday.
Yay, Chuck.
Woo!
Love you.
Yes. Woo! Happy birthday, Chuck.
Happy birthday, Chuck. Thank you for having me on the show. I loved doing this one. This is one of the most fun times I've ever had doing a podcast, and I'm sincere about that. Love being on here with you guys. Thank you so much.
Right back at you.
Yeah, it's one of those, the itch you finally get to scratch. You get to talk about something you love with people that love talking about it. So thanks so much, Steven and Josh. I appreciate it.
No, thank you both. This is my favorite podcast. I don't want to steal your thunder, Mark, but this was a true joy. So
you just stole it.
Yeah.
Well, thank you both. It's okay to steal. You know, it's okay.
Yes.
Hope everybody enjoyed that episode. I know I did, and I just want to thank Mark and Josh again for joining me. If anybody has any feedback, you can send it to us at diecastmoviepodcast@gmail.com, or you can also leave us a message on our Facebook page. We're going to be ending the episode in just a minute with another song, The Omega Man from Iron Survivor. But we did get some feedback from Mike T, who gave us feedback about our Xandor Vorkoff interview, which was just a couple episodes ago. He replied, "Great interview of Xandor. His theatrical background was a real eye-opener. His outlook on kindness should be spread far and wide, and your show will help do that. Well done." And I just want to thank Mike for the feedback. And again, if you want to leave feedback, please do so at diecastmoviepodcast@gmail.com or leave us a message on our Facebook page or message us like Mike did. Hope everybody has a good day, and I'm going to thank everybody for listening. And now we're going to listen to The Omega Man by Iron Survivor.
Omega Man.